Hello, it's Friday the 14th of January and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. North Korea has launched another two projectiles believed to be ballistic missiles in what is the third provocation in 9 days. We'll have the latest details in our news briefing shortly. Later, we'll be looking closer at the economic policies of the main presidential candidates and assessing their feasibility for weekly economy review. Then coming up for Movie Spotlight, we'll have reviews of Steven Spielberg's West Side Story and local action film Special Delivery starring Parasite's Park So-dam. We'll have all that and more on today's Korea 24. North Korea fired what the South Korean military believed were two ballistic missiles eastward on Friday. This comes after Pyongyang publicly warned earlier in the day of a stronger and certain response to the announcement of new sanctions by the U.S. To update us with the latest provocation from the North and our other headlines of the day, our KBS World Radio news editor Ku Hee-jin joins us over the line. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, General.
So it seems North Korea is putting its words into action. What do we know of the missiles that were fired today?
Well, according to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on Friday, North Korea fired two short-range projectiles that it believes were ballistic in nature from a site in North Pyongan Province, a northwestern region bordering China. This is the third test launch by North Korea in just over a week. Pyongyang had claimed on Tuesday that it successfully conducted a final test of a hypersonic missile. Military authorities are reportedly analyzing details of the latest launch, including the range and altitude. This comes on the same day that the North's foreign ministry released a statement through the Korean Central News Agency warning of a stronger and certain reaction if the U.S. adopts a confrontational stance, referring to these sanctions. Washington on Wednesday imposed sanctions on 6 North Koreans, 1 Russian, and a Russian firm responsible for procuring goods for the North's weapons program.
Now, this development comes as the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also talked about repercussions and consequences for these actions by North Korea. Can you expand on his comments there?
Yes, Blinken said in an interview with MSNBC that he thinks North Korea may be seeking attention with its missile launches as it has done in the past, and it will probably continue to do so. He also said the U.S. and its allies are now focused on making sure that there are repercussions and consequences for these actions by North Korea. Blinken pointed out that Washington had stated months ago that it was ready to engage with the North with no preconditions to see if they could find a way towards the total denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, to which North has unfortunately shown no response. Blinken said that the recent missile tests are profoundly destabilizing and violate UN Security Council resolutions.
The UN Security Council is expected to meet again next week to discuss these latest launches, so we will bring updates on that when they do. Let's turn now to news concerning the pandemic. A Seoul court on Friday partially suspended the government's COVID-19 pass system, which could potentially impede the government's efforts to contain the spread of the virus. So what can you tell us, Hee-jin?
Well, the ruling by the Seoul Administrative Court immediately suspended the validity of pass requirements at shops, marts and department stores as large as 3,000 square meters or more in the city. The pass system has also been suspended for children aged 12 to 17, enabling them to use all 17 facilities subject to the system without presenting a pass. PC rooms, restaurants, cafes, movie theaters, and sports stadiums are not included in the suspension of the pass system. The suspension will also be limited to facilities in the capital city, as the court made the verdict in response to an injunction filed against Seoul Mayor Oh Tae-hoon. It will remain effective for 30 days.
And the ruling comes on the same day that the government announced that it would ease caps on private gatherings to 6 from the current 4. However, it will maintain its 9 p.m. curfews on cafes and restaurants for another 3 weeks. Can you tell us more?
Yes, Prime Minister Kim Bok-yeom announced on Friday that the government has decided to extend current social distancing rules by 3 weeks, but to adjust the cap on private gatherings in consideration of the public's stress and pain due to the prolonged antivirus measures. The Prime Minister said that while some areas are showing improvement, infections are currently not decreasing, with just 2 weeks until Lunar New Year. Additionally, there is a rapid increase of Omicron cases to consider. The Korean Disease Control and Prevention Agency projected that Omicron will become the dominant COVID-19 variant in about a week. The adjustments will be applied for 3 weeks from Monday through February 6th. The KDCA reported 4,542 daily new infections on Friday to raise the daily cumulative total to 683,566. Some 409 cases were from overseas, topping the 400 mark for the first time and posting a record for 3 consecutive days.
Meanwhile, the government announced plans to draw up a supplementary budget worth 14 trillion won to further help small businesses adversely affected by the pandemic. Can you give us more details?
Of course. Finance Minister Hong Nam-ki said in a briefing in Seoul on Friday that through the extra budget, the government will provide an additional 3 million won each to small businesses who suffered a decline in sales to help lessen their burdens in paying rent and labor. The funds will add to 10 trillion won and will be in addition to the 1 million won relief offered to small businesses in December. The government will also raise the compensation budget for businesses subject to the government's quarantine restrictions by 1.9 trillion won to 5.1 trillion won. Much of these funds will be financed with excess tax revenue estimated at 10 trillion won. President Moon Jae-in on Thursday ordered the government to draw up measures to use excess tax revenue for relief grants.
And finally, the South Korean Central Bank raised its key interest rate by a quarter percentage point amid soaring household debt and growing inflationary pressure. This pushes the benchmark rate to pre-pandemic levels then, Hee-jin.
Indeed, Bank of Korea's Monetary Policy Board announced its decision to raise rates to 1.25% on Friday, hiking the key rate for a second consecutive time after the previous raise in November last year. The BOK slashed its benchmark rate by half a percentage point to 0.75% in March 2020 to boost the pandemic-hit economy. It lowered the rate by another quarter percentage point to 0.5% 2 months later. The central bank said Friday that it made the move because the high vaccination rate has allowed for an economic recovery despite the arrival of variants. Bank of Korea Governor Lee Ji-yeol has already hinted more interest rate hikes are in the offing for this year, in line with similar moves in other major nations, including the U.S.
We wrap it up there for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates, Hee-jin.
Thank you, Jang-ho.
It's time now for our Friday in-depth weekly economy review. Now, we're going to take a little detour today from our usual review. Instead of discussing the major economic issues of the week, we're going to take a closer look at some of the key economic pledges from the four main presidential candidates. Because with the elections less than 2 months away now, scandals and controversies have started to take a back seat and policy announcements are gaining more attention. To assess the pledges and their feasibility, we have joining us in the studio our regular guest for this segment, economics professor Yang Jun-sak from the Catholic University of Korea. Professor Yang, hello, it's good to see you.
Happy to be here.
Let's begin with a quick update on the Kospi Index. COSDAC. How did they fare this week, Professor?
Okay, for the COSB, it was up on Tuesday and Wednesday, but it was down on all other days. Wednesday, they actually did fairly well at more than 2% rise, but the rest of the days dragged the index down. It closed today at 2,923.54. It was down 1.3% today. For the entire week, it was down 1.1%. For the COSDAC, it was up Wednesday by more than 2%. But it was down on all other days. It closed today at 971.83. It was down 1.2% today. For the entire week, it was down 2.3%. U.S. dollar, after depreciating and breaking the 1,200 won barrier last week, this week it strengthened. So it closed today at 1,187.00. For the entire week, it appreciated by 1.3%.
Okay, so let's get into the economic policies from the main presidential candidates, starting with the ruling Democratic Party's Lee Jae-myung. The former Gyeonggi Province governor vowed on Tuesday this week that he would make South Korea the world's fifth strongest economy through major transformations in industry, land, science, technology and education. He also pledged to see the nation's annual exports surpass $1 trillion under his government. On Wednesday, he announced his industrial transition plan, pledging financial support and deregulation in 10 future industries, including semiconductors, secondary batteries, robots and aerospace. So, Professor, what have you made of Lee's pledges this week? What does being the fifth strongest economy mean exactly, and is that really feasible?
Okay, well, I have to give Lee Jae-myung credit. He's the first one out of the gate with a more or less comprehensive economic look at the type of economic policy he wants to pursue. The other candidates, they have stated some pieces, they have stated some principles, but they have not come up with sort of a comprehensive announcement that Lee Jae-myung made this week. He's calling it Egenomics. I think it's a sort of a tradition on Korean presidential candidates that they name economic policies after themselves.
Sure, not just Korea, of course. There's Abenomics as well in the Japan.
But they do not name it themselves.
Right. Okay, I see. Yes.
But anyhow, having said that, I think as a slogan, Lee said the top five economic country and 1 trillion won exports, that is going to be very difficult. I think it has more of a meaning as a slogan, like what we saw in Lee Myung-bak's presidency 10-15 years ago when he had that 747 policy. 7% growth rate, 50,000 GDP per capita, and so on. Seventh largest country in the world. It was almost numerically impossible to achieve, but it was a good slogan.
Right.
And I think it's similar over here, because if we look at the numbers, I won't say it's impossible, but it's not really clear we can get there from here within the term of Lee Jae-myung's presidential term if he gets elected president.
Right, so it's a bit more aspirational than perhaps a target that can be achieved immediately.
Yeah, so number-wise, in 2019, Korea was 12th largest economy in nominal dollars, 14th largest in purchasing power parity dollars. I prefer working in purchasing parity dollars because it's less affected by short-term exchange rate changes. And in 2019, that I chose 2019 because it was before the pandemic.
Okay.
And it was about, Korean GDP was about $2.2 trillion. And the fifth largest economy is Germany at $4.6 trillion. So in between 2019 to 2027, Korean economy has to grow twice as large. Mm. And that's assuming Germany doesn't grow.
Right.
So that's we need about 9% growth per year, and that's obviously going to be very difficult. $1 trillion exports per year. This year, it was a record-setting export at $621 billion. So we need additional $380 billion to make $1 trillion exports. That requires about 7% growth per year. Again, I won't go as far as say it's impossible, but it's really hard to see how we get there from here. But again, I do think that Lee Jae-myung is the first to present a sort of a comprehensive plan and vision, though not much details. So if you do go into some of the details here, Egenomics seems to follow much of the Moon Jae-in's policy textbooks. It has emphasis on new technologies, digital, clean energy, biotech, lots of government money to establish and foster these industries. So one of the ways that Lee Jae-myung is pitching his economic policy is we're going to invest a lot of government monies in these industries. And for example, 135 trillion won for transformation to digital economy, which he hopes will generate 1 million digital workers and presumably new jobs for these workers. He will establish a Ministry of Climate and Energy and what he calls Wind and Solar Energy Highway, Climate Response Fund, worker training for the new clean technologies, for venture and SMEs, 10 trillion won fund for fostering the venture SMEs, expanding technology guarantees by 100%, services foster K content, so presumably movies, music, and so on. Exports, increase the categories where Korea leads globally from current 69 to 1,000 to achieve 5,000 on KOSPI index, institute one strike and you're out, policy for stock manipulation, elevate Minister of Science and ICT to a vice minister. Mm. And basically, as we can see here, large investments in infrastructure and development. Basically, let's put a lot of government money here to increase the size of these industries.
Sure.
Now, he does mention private investment somewhat, but compared to other candidates, he doesn't seem to emphasize it as much. And also he does emphasize regulatory reform, but he sort of contradicted himself a few times when he mentioned regulatory reform. For example, when he said the country needed regulatory reform, I think everybody agrees with that. But then just a few hours afterwards, he said that we should limit the number of small restaurants that people can establish. That's a major regulation.
Right.
So there is some concern there. He also has an on and off fascination with universal basic income. So far, the amount that he suggested ranged from 250,000 won to 1 million won. And it's not quite clear exactly where the money is going to come from. And then, as with other major candidates, he is advocating increasing the housing supply. But again, it's government emphasized, government rental units mostly.
Okay, let's move swiftly on to the main opposition People Power Party and candidate Yoon Sang-yeol. During a New Year's press conference on Tuesday, Yoon said he will double the nation's growth potential and capacity to create jobs through what he called a fair, innovative economy driven by the private sector. But it was perhaps his more smaller local pledges that caught the attention. He said he will introduce a system for small businesses where the rent for premises will be shared by the lessor, lessee, and the state. Meanwhile, he promised to provide 1 million won every month for a year to new parents as part of efforts to overcome the nation's low birth rate. So quite a few policy announcements on Tuesday alone there. What has stood out for you the most?
Okay, well, before I go on, I have some few family and friends working for Yoon's camp.
Right,
so
okay.
I hope I won't be too biased.
Okay.
But again, it seems to be more sloganeering rather than concrete details.
Mm.
He didn't mention raising the Korea's potential output from 2% to 4%. But problem is how? If you want to raise potential output, you need to increase the birth rate or increase capital or increase productivity. And he did as you mentioned, he said that let's have some more birth, 1 million won subsidy per month per child. But it's not entirely clear whether just the lack of money is responsible for the Korea's low birth rate. And he's not yet mentioned other methods to try to raise Korea's birth rate. Liberalizing lending regulations for the poor and young so that they could purchase a house, and then paying one third of rent for small businesses, guaranteeing payment for property owners. So this, while it's supposed to be for small business owners, it may actually benefit landowners or property owners more because you're guaranteeing part of the rent from government money. So I would think that it would be better just giving subsidy to small business owners and let them figure out what to do with the money, whether they want to spend it on rents or spend it elsewhere. And then he also advocates increasing housing supply through changes in regulation. And his method for increasing housing supply is mostly through private sector. He also did emphasize regulatory reform. His advisors have stated that they're thinking about establishing a government agency, a permanent agency, which just looks at regulatory reform. I actually like that idea quite a bit, but he hasn't stated any type of details on what type of agency that they're looking for or even really committed to building that agency. He advocates loosening lending regulations for the young so they can buy housing, as I mentioned earlier, increasing the LTV ratio to up to 80%, which is, I think, a bit dangerous because you're encouraging young people to take on a lot of debt. It may work, it may not, but I think just changing the LTV is not enough. You need other policies to support it as well.
Let's also discuss the minor opposition candidates now. First, the People's Party candidate An Chol-soo, who has support now in double digits in recent polls. He announced a rather bold reform plan for pensions. He said all pensions like the national pension, military pension and government employees' pension need to be unified. He pointed to research that showed the national pension in South Korea is expected to be depleted by 2055 and that those born after 1990 won't be able to receive any pension under the current situation. So, Professor, what do you make of this pledge?
Okay, well, this is a well-known problem, actually. It comes up every few years and not necessarily even during government, not necessarily during the presidential elections. And unifying all, consolidating all pensions have been presented as a solution before, but it's usually presented as an incomplete solution. That's because basically, the fundamental problem is demographics. It's just that the some pensions have some excess funds in the short term and shortages in the long run. So any type of consolidation can only be a short-term solution. What you really need to do is increase the contributions by the workers while they're working and also delay the age where you can get the pension payments. But there's a lot of problems because if you want to delay the retirement age, there's resistance from the young because they fear that jobs will not open up. There's resistance from the companies because typically in Korea, if you work longer, you get paid more, and that's outstripping the productivity of the older workers. And older workers, if they have to take a pay cut to stay in the company, they do not necessarily want to stay in the company. So until we work that conflict of interest out, we're going to be stuck with the pension problem, and consolidating is only going to be a temporary fix.
Finally, let's touch upon the Justice Party's Shim Sang-jung, whose campaign is going through a bit of a crisis, but nevertheless remains a key figure in this race. Last week, she vowed to introduce a four-day workweek system without wage cuts. She cited research which said the implementation of the system would lead to a 1.5-fold increase in productivity per person. So, Professor, could a four-day workweek really be possible?
Well, I'm effectively working a four-day work week, so it would be a bit hypocritical to offer otherwise. But there's no clear evidence. There is a study by KDI, but there's no clear-cut evidence that productivity will increase enough so that it'll cover the reduction in working hours. In fact, it's very likely that it'll be different from industry to industry. White-collar workers, probably. But factory workers, face-to-face service providers like people who work in restaurants, unskilled workers, they may not be able to increase their productivity enough to cover for the reduction in working hours. And that means that for those workers, they may have to take a pay cut. And obviously, they're going to resist that. And also another problem is that a lot of times this type of limits on working hours, they don't really concern themselves with how much rest you actually get, but rather it's a problem with overtime and pay. Because in Korean, by Korean law, if you work overtime, then you get 150 to 200% of your hourly wages. So sometimes unions want the working hours to be reduced so that they can work the same number of hours but get paid overtime. So this is another problem that's going to be have to be worked out as well, especially for low productivity workers, if they want to actually introduce four-day work week.
Okay, so we've whisked through the main candidates and their pledges. Professor, just before we go, what do you make of the economic issues being discussed in this election as a broad whole? Do you think they are focusing on the right issues?
Well, they are beginning to focus on the right issues. Problem is, a lot of it is just doesn't include concrete details. So it's really hard to connect the dots. We know where we want to go, but how are we going to get there from here? And they have not made those technical details very clear. It's very hard to do that in a presidential election, but still, some hint of exactly what kind of concrete policies they're offering rather than just goals would be very useful.
We'll leave it there. Professor Yang, we appreciate your thoughts as always, and we hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. Benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 40.17 points or 1.36% on Friday, closing the week at 2,921.92. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 11.86 points or 1.21% to close at 971.39. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 0.21 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,187.31. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's our daily segment, Korea Trending. This is where we find out some of the other news stories that people have been looking up online in Korea today. And with those stories for us is Walter Lee, who's joined us now in the studio. Walter, hello.
Hello, Jung-ho. Happy Friday.
Yes, happy Friday to you too. So what topics do you have for us today?
Okay, so we'll find out the Supreme Court's ruling for a former personal bank manager accused of tampering with the hiring process. We'll then learn why there is so much riding on the success of Gangwon Province's Legoland Korea Resort, set to open in spring. And finally, we'll talk about the ultra-popular Baby Shark Dance video, making history yet again.
Okay, so we start with a court case involving an HR manager at a bank. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so the Supreme Court sentenced on Friday a former personnel manager of the KB Gungmin Bank to 1 year in prison for obstruction of business, upholding a lower court ruling. The former manager, surnamed Oh, is accused of tampering with evaluation scores of applicants in the process of recruiting new employees in 2015. Oh allegedly raised the scores of 113 male applicants while lowering the scores of 112 female applicants, all in the bid to hire more men. Also, in recruiting new personnel between 2015 and 2017, Oh allegedly fabricated interview scores of 28 applicants, leading to 20 people to wrongfully land a job in the bank.
Okay, so this employee had manipulated the scores to hire those who are less qualified just because they were men. Now, the Supreme Court has sentenced him to serve a year in prison, but understand that during Orr's first trial, he had received just a suspended sentence.
Yeah, that's right. So initially, Orr was sentenced to 1 year in prison, suspended for 2 years. In issuing such a verdict in October 2018, the Seoul Southern District Court said Oh had not gained economic profit from manipulating evaluation scores and was sticking to wrongful practices. But then last July, Oh was taken into custody after an appeals court overturned the suspension and issued a 1 year prison sentence. The courts dismissed Oh's claims that sought to select applicants in a way that wouldn't be concentrated on one particular gender. The court also said it recognized that Oh plotted with the others accused in fabricating the evaluation scores, thus intentionally obstructing business.
Right, so other employees of the bank were also suspected of taking part in this score tampering scheme then?
Yes, there were three more. So the Supreme Court maintained the previous ruling for these three officials who worked in the bank's personnel management department. Two of them were sentenced to 1 year in prison, suspended for 2 years, and the third 10 months in prison, suspended for 2 years. The Supreme Court also fined KB Gumin Bank 5 million won, again upholding a lower court ruling.
Right, so the Supreme Court taking a particularly firm stance against the main perpetrator of this crime, of this sort of unfair hiring practices. Okay, let's move on. What else do you have for us?
Okay, so the next story is about a KBS report on Legoland Korea Resort, set to open May 5th or Children's Day here in South Korea. The resort is located on Jung Island, a small island on Uiam Lake in Chuncheon, Gangwon Province. Construction of the resort on 300,000 square meters of land is still underway and set to be completed in March. The envisioned facility will house some 40 themed rides for children ages between 2 to 12, as well as Miniland, which will feature key landmark properties in Seoul, Busan, and Gangwon Province, built out of millions of Lego bricks. The resort will also include a four-story hotel with 154 rooms.
Okay, so Legoland is a popular theme park attraction in many countries, but the construction of Legoland Korea made headlines because it came across some unexpected obstacles, right, Walter?
Yeah, that's correct. So take note that the ground was first broken for the resort 11 years ago. During the first stage of construction, large-scale historical sites were uncovered with remains of houses and graves dating back to the Bronze Age. Civic groups to this day are protesting the construction, claiming the effort could destroy valuable artifacts and ruins. Now, according to KBS, another major problem regarding the resort is the fact that Gangwon Province has much to lose if the resort does not make a hefty profit. To have Jung Island house the resort, the province has offered the island rent-free for 100 years. It also injected 400 billion won, that's nearly $340 million, in public funds to attract 100 billion won in foreign investment.
Right, so you're saying the province essentially struck a deal with Legoland Korea, giving them some incentives, thinking that having this attraction would help the local economy, but the costs of the construction establishing this site perhaps have been greater than expected. Mm. How well, then, would the resort have to do in order for Gangwon not to suffer financially?
Well, unless the resort reaps 40 billion won, which is around $33 million in sales annually, the province will end up with pretty much nothing in its pockets. Given this fact, Gangwon residents are eagerly hoping Legoland will become a major tourist attraction.
Right, so Gangwon and Legoland Korea feeling the financial pressure then. We'll see if it does become a major attraction or a sort of controversial white elephant. Okay, let's move on to our final story for today. What do you have for us?
Okay, so the mega popular Baby Shark dance video has made history by becoming the world's first YouTube video to surpass 10 billion views. Creator The Pink Fong Company announced the video reached the 10 billion view milestone at around 4 p.m. on Thursday. If you're one of the few who hasn't seen it, the video features dance moves to the addictive children's song Baby Shark in English. Since it was first uploaded on YouTube in June 2016, the video has drawn strong popularity not only among children but adults alike, and including Hollywood celebrities, thanks to its upbeat rhythm and easy to follow dance moves.
Yes, it's been a cultural phenomenon. 10 billion views, that is remarkable. And it was already the Guinness World Record holder as the most viewed video on YouTube. And that was a few years back already, right?
Yeah, that's right. So in November 2020, after outdoing the music video of Despacito by Luis Fonse and Daddy Yankee, currently the Baby Shark dance video has drawn around 2.3 billion views more than Despacito, which currently sits as the second most viewed video on YouTube.
Right, so it's got quite a lead, and it looks like it's going to hold on to that number one spot for quite a while then. Right. I understand that the creator of the video commented on this latest feat as well.
Yeah, so Pink Fong CEO Kim Min-seok described the latest milestone as a momentum that proved the power Baby Shark has in terms of intellectual property in the overall entertainment industry. He made the remark after citing that the video became the world's most viewed YouTube video of all time and earned the Recording Industry Association of America's highest award award, the Diamond Certification. Kim then vowed the company will continue to create content loved by fans around the world and lead a culture in which One content can be enjoyed by all family members.
Indeed. That's where we'll leave it for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Walton, and we'll see you again next week.
See you next week.
It's time now for our weekly Friday segment, Movie Spotlight, where we discuss some of the latest releases at the Korean box office and on streaming services online. And for that, we have joining us in the studio our esteemed panel of critics, Jason Vesheves and Darcy Paquette. Gentlemen, hello and happy Friday.
Hi, Jango.
Hello, Jango. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So, today we have a major new Hollywood musical to kick things off. And it's a director Steven Spielberg's remake of the classic musical West Side Story. Now, many eyebrows were raised when it was announced that Spielberg would be taking on this project. But against all odds, it seems that the film has emerged as one of the leading contenders for the Best Picture Oscar at the Academy Awards in March. Now, Darcy, before we talk about this new film, can you give us an overview of the previous incarnations of the story?
Yes, I mean, it is certainly a classic and one that's familiar from people from various high school productions over the years. But the original musical came out in September 1957 on Broadway. It was conceived, choreographed, and directed by Jerome Robbins, with music by Leonard Bernstein, and also lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. This was his kind of first foray into the musical world. Mm. At the time of its release, it was considered kind of daring and dark for its time. I mean, there are dead bodies that come into this, of course, and but also the music. I mean, the music was sort of cutting edge. If you listen to a song like Maria, like the intervals in that song are kind of crazy, and it was something new, I think, musically for Broadway as well. And so people weren't sure if it would be popular, but it ended up becoming very popular, and it ran with a run of 732 productions in Broadway. Then it went to the West End in London, and had an even longer run of over 1,000 productions. So now it is a classic. But of course, you know, in a few years, there was also a film version that was released in 1961. So it was co-directed by Jerome Robbins and also Robert Wise, starring Natalie Wood and Robert Baymer. It's hard to kind of overstate how successful it was.
Right.
It was the highest grossing movie of 1961. It also won 10 Oscars, including Best Picture. On lists of the greatest film musicals of all time, it's consistently up, you know, very near the top. But at the same time, it's a film that, you know, has certain elements that haven't aged well. And, you know, the casting of a white actress in the leading role as a Puerto Rican woman is hard to ignore. And in other ways, you know, the film doesn't have the cultural sensitivity that we'd expect of films today. And some people even go far as to argue that the work is kind of beyond saving. So, you know, when Spielberg announced that he and his screenwriter, Tony Kushner, who's also white, were making this adaptation, there was, a lot of skepticism.
Right. So despite its place in history, the original film, it hasn't aged that well, and there was a bit of baggage associated with it. So Jason, with that in mind then, how did Spielberg and Kushner approach this project? What did they want to do that was new?
Well, one thing they did was in terms of the location. So it's very, very specific about where the film is set, and it's set during the bulldozing of an entire neighborhood for redevelopment, and it's the place actually where Lincoln Center stands today. And the conflict between the Jets, this is the white teenage gang, and the Sharks, who come from a Puerto Rican migrant community, this all plays out, I think, in a manner that echoes somewhat today, given the racial issues in the United States that continue. The essence of the music and dancing is pretty much maintained. I mean, the feel of the film actually feels very kind of classic Hollywood, and that's what I liked about it. It was sitting in a theater yesterday, or a cinema, It just felt really nostalgic, and I had a really, really good time. And yet, there are aspects to it that feel quite new too. So we should also note that Rita Moreno, who played the role of Anita in the 1961 film, returns in this film. She plays a pharmacist named Valentina, and so there's a direct link there to the original film.
Right. She's one of the best things about the new film.
Yeah, she's terrific.
Right, so updating it with the times, but also paying homage to the classic original. So, Darcy, as we said, Spielberg, he seems to have won over a lot of critics. Were you one of them? Has it won you over as well?
It did win me over. You know, I think it was on this program back when we were talking about On the Heights last summer that I kind of, I don't know, talked down the prospect of this film and that I wasn't really expecting very much out of it. And I should publicly take those words back because it is really kind of amazing how well this film was pulled off.
In what ways?
Well, I think that, I mean, more so than the issues of cultural sensitivity. I mean, I think they did kind of walk the fine line about keeping the classic elements of the musical and also making it feel a little bit more contemporary. And they did that well. But I think the key thing is that, you know, Spielberg is just such a talented director. And, you know, filmmaking is often about deciding where to put the cameras and where to cut things in order to create the certain energy on screen. And he's always been really good at that, but he's never shot a musical before. And I think what a lot of critics felt as they were sitting in the theater watching this for the first time was like, oh my God, you know, Spielberg is perfect for this kind of a musical. And I mean, it's kind of ironic that, you know, it's this late in his career that he's shooting his first musical, but it does seem kind of like the perfect match.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the musical numbers are some of the best I've ever seen, honestly. I had some issue with some of the lighting. This was flagged up on a recent podcast I was listening to.
Lots of lens flares. Well.
Yeah, no, but it's not just this film. It's some of other Spielberg's movies as well. If you watch, like, Saving Private Ryan, the Omaha Beach sequence, it's incredible. But the lighting in some places is just, it's just not quite right. So, like, the filters they use. Anyway, but that aside, visually, it took me a little while to kind of get adjusted to it. But half an hour in, I was like, my jaw just dropped to the ground.
Wow, okay. So two ringing endorsements, it seems. How does it compare to the original, though?
Yeah, I mean, it's more easy to embrace this film, obviously, from today's perspective. And, you know, the original as well as it was made and as much as its strengths really do stand out, you know, the weaknesses are just so glaring.
Right.
And so in a sense, we needed an update of this story. And, you know, and in some ways too, I mean, this is a project where you have kind of this, you know, this love story at the center. I mean, the love story, you know, they meet like a day later, they're talking about getting married in some sense. You know,
well, it is based on Romeo and Juliet.
It is,
so.
You know, this isn't a relationship you really believe in, but I don't think you have to in order to enjoy the film because it's, I mean, it's about the whole setting and everything else. And it's a work that's about more than just its story.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's classic Hollywood. I mean, Spielberg, there's no filmmaker better than Spielberg to bring this to life. And he is a sensitive filmmaker to these issues, and I've long admired him. I grew up watching his films, and, you know, watching this again just brought all that back. And visually absolutely fantastic, albeit with some of the lighting issues. He probably just does that to annoy me.
There's one more brief thing to note. For those who want to go see this film, that we should mention, Spielberg made the decision in this film not to subtitle the Spanish dialogue. In a press conference, he said it was out of respect that we didn't subtitle any of the Spanish. That language had to exist in equal proportions alongside the English with no help. Darcy, first, do you know if that's the same in screenings here in Korea? And second, what are your thoughts on this decision, especially as an acclaimed subtitle writer yourself?
I mean, it is the case here. The Spanish subtitle, there isn't a huge amount of Spanish dialogue, but it does, you know, continually come up throughout the course of the film, including in some pretty dramatic moments. And there are no Korean subtitles for those, or English. So, you know, I'm really divided about this because in one sense, you know, as an American living in America, where Spanish is sort of an unofficial second language, in the sense that, A lot of people speak it either natively or grew up with it, and then many more people have studied it in school because it's a very popular language to study. And I mean, it sort of makes sense within the context of the US, but I mean, watching it in Korea, suddenly, you know, it didn't feel like the Spanish was being treated with respect. It felt like it wasn't being given the respect of being translated. And so we understand everything that the English, you know, all of the English, and then we understand none of the Spanish unless, you know, you speak Spanish, and not many, you know, people in Asia speak Spanish. So, yeah, I wish that they'd internationally taken a different decision with that. I mean, to me, it feels like that is a lost.
I guess they perhaps could still do so in releases for like DVD or streaming services, but it's certainly an interesting decision, as you said.
Yeah, well, I got an email invitation to the press screening, and it said in the email that much like the US and the UK and everywhere else, they were not going to subtitle the Spanish, and so I kind of knew that anyway. But I totally agree with Darcy. It does feel a little bit odd here. I can understand in the US why that might work, but less so elsewhere.
Okay, we have to move on now, and our second title of the week, it's a high-octane local action film called Special Delivery, or Tuksong in Korean. And perhaps the aspect that will catch most people's attention is that it features Park So-dam in the lead role. She is, of course, best known for playing Ki-jung, or Jessica, in the film Parasite. So, Jason, what can you tell us about this film?
Yeah, Park So-dam, she plays Una, who officially works at a junkyard in Busan. But her real job, however, is a crack driver for an underground company that promises to deliver literally anything that the post office won't handle. And one day the company is contacted by a man on the run because of his involvement in a gambling scheme. And the man asks for him and his young son to be driven to a port where he can basically flee the country with fake passports. But from the moment Una arrives on the scene, things obviously just go wrong.
Things go wrong.
And
yes.
She ends up driving away and getting into trouble, and obviously the boy's in the car, and that's the kind of central relationship that I think works for me anyway, at least. And so, yeah, she's fleeting for her life and trying to protect this boy from a corrupt cop played by Song Se-byeok.
So, Darcy, as I mentioned, the casting of Park So-dam will get the greatest attention. Was she a good pick for this role? It sounds very different from what we saw of her in Parasite.
Yes, but that's what makes it exciting. There's like that quote, you had me at hello. And for me, this film had me at, you know, Park So-dam in an action movie, like in the leading role, because she is a great actress who, you know, I've been following over the years, and she had her breakout with Parasite, but yeah, it's not often that, you know, in these kinds of films in Korea, women are really kind of put, you know, in this kind of an action leading role. It doesn't happen sometimes. I mean, there are other examples of it in the past, but yeah, you know, it's a lot of, it is very kinetic film. It's, you know, the driving sequences are quite elaborate, and it's a lot of fun.
The trailer reminded me of Baby Driver.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like a Korean version of Baby Driver in many ways. She's the driver who's brought in to take people out of trouble.
Yeah, so there's a trend in Korean cinema, well, a recent trend, I think, in terms of films featuring racing cars or cars. And there's Hit and Run, directed by Hajini, starring Kong Yoo-jin. There's also a Netflix film that's coming out that's set in the 1980s, and Yoon, I think, is in it, and it's going to be featuring lots of car races. I think Park So-dam is good in this film. There's certainly some interesting set pieces. I'm not so keen on Song Se-byeok, though. I thought he kind of...
As
the bad guy.
Well, he just overcooked it. I mean, he has this like really annoying voice, and he's so bad. I mean, he basically just kills anyone that gets in his way, and it just becomes just completely unrealistic. I know that's kind of half the point, but you got this like cop on a killing spree, and the press aren't really talking about it. They're just talking about this gambling scheme. So apart from that, yeah, it was fun for sure.
comparing it to Baby Driver. Baby Driver is very unique in its visual style. Mm-hmm. Does this match up, or is it unfair to compare the two perhaps?
Well, I mean, this definitely isn't as stylish. And I mean, in some ways, this just feels like a film made of fairly simple ingredients, but those ingredients work. And, you know, the plot is not too complicated. The visuals are not too flashy. It's just that, you know, the action scenes are fast. And also the central relationship between Park Sadam and the boy. I think it would be a different kind of film if you didn't have that relationship in it as well, because the boy is really cute. And, you know, you really feel for him. And then when things start to get quite intense and extreme towards the end, it does keep you on the edge of your seat.
Okay, so once again, it's called Special Delivery or Tuksong. That's where we'll wrap it up for Movie Spotlight this week. Gentlemen, thank you as always for your thoughts and reviews.
Thank you very much.
Have a great weekend.
We've come now to our Friday closing segment next week from Seoul, where we take a look at what's coming up in the week ahead. And rounding up those events for us is our staff editor, Mark Wilson-Chair, who's joined us now in the studio. Mark, hello. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Okay, so what do we need to look out for next week, Mark?
Right. You discussed this earlier on the show, Jungle, but let me remind our listeners of COVID-19-related rule changes. From next Monday to February 6th, private gatherings will be allowed to be up to 6 people from the current 4. However, the government will still keep the strict 9 p.m. business hours curfew for restaurants and cafes. The decision to adjust the private meeting cap was made in consideration of public strain and woes amid the prolonged antivirus measures. From next Thursday, all inbound travelers will no longer be allowed to use public transportation when leaving the point of arrival to their final destinations. They will only be allowed to use their own vehicles or designated quarantine vehicles. In addition, the required time for PCR test result issuance will be shortened to 48 hours from the current 72. All inbound travelers must submit a negative PCR test result before departure.
Right, we have thankfully seen a slowdown in infections recently, but the government is remaining cautious, it seems then, particularly with the rise in overseas transmissions that we've been seeing lately. Okay, moving on. What else is set to happen next week, Mark?
All throughout next week, President Moon Jae-in will be making the rounds in the Middle East, hitting up 3 countries from January 15th to the 22nd. His first stop will be the United Arab Emirates. On Sunday, he'll be in Dubai and will also take part in a Korean National Day event at the Dubai Expo. On Monday, he'll discuss bilateral relations with the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Mohammed bin Zayed. On Tuesday, he'll head to Saudi Arabia for 2 days to talk with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Moon will then go to Egypt at the invitation of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi to discuss cooperation and sustainable growth. A presidential spokesperson said that the visit will both solidify cooperative ties, which includes an energy construction infrastructure, as well as future sectors, including public health, science, hydrogen, and climate.
Yes, we covered the significance of this trip in our in-depth segment on Wednesday. So any listeners who want to learn more can listen back to that on our podcasts, which you can find on our KBS World website or on our most popular podcast platforms. Okay, let's look at one more then. What else is happening next week, Mark?
Next week, the Seoul Eastern District Court is expected to make its verdict on Olympic speed skating champion Shim Seok-hee's last-ditch effort to compete at the 2022 Beijing Winter Olympics. You've previously covered how Shim was suspended from Team Korea by the Korea Skating Union in December for making disparaging comments on her teammates and coaching staff at the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, if you remember. Mm. The 2-month ban makes her ineligible to compete in Beijing next month, and last Thursday, Shim filed for a court injunction against the penalty slapped on her by the KSU. Now, the thing is, even if the court sides with Shim, it doesn't mean she's automatically headed to Beijing. If the KSU determines that Shim, who hasn't been competing nor training in a structured setting for the past few months, isn't in the shape to compete, it can still decide to keep her off the team.
Right, but of course, we'll see which way the court decides first and then see whether the KSU will have to make that choice or not down the line. Okay, those were some of the headlines to look out for next week. Mark, thank you for that roundup, and we hope you have a great weekend.
You too.
And that brings us to the end of another week here on Korea 24. Join us again on Monday, where we'll be doing it all over again, bringing you the latest headlines, analysis of the key stories from Korea. Till then, we hope you have a great weekend. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.